instructions for that on the board?
Yeah, I thought it would wait until we start reading the first one. No, so it should have been ready to go during the video.
So I wonder, like, when I was going to expect it.
Right, want to be able to budget this time, you understand?
Yeah. All right, I was trying to think of a way to give you a very rapid overview of Dostoevsky's chronology during this early period. In other words, what happened before he wrote The Idiot. And so today we're going to try to fill in some of that gap. Now, actually, he wrote quite a bit. And there is his imprisonment and exile, which had a considerable impact on his life, to say nothing of his literary career. So I'm going to let you read this, or I wouldn't have written it all down. There's no point in my reading it to you. But I thought I would highlight some of the works that already, from the moment of his first novel, or short novel, or long short story, or novella, or whatever we want to call it, Poor Folk, sometimes translated as Poor People, that I talked about a little bit last time. The thing is that Poor Folk launched Dostoevsky's career because Belinsky was so enthusiastic about it. And these early years, it was a little bit like a Hollywood star who's an overnight sensation and then doesn't have any hits for a singer who has one top of the chart smash hit and then nobody likes anything else he's written. The truth of the matter is that Belinsky liked Poor Folk for what we would think of now as the wrong reasons. You know, he saw it in some ways as a political tract. And Dostoevsky was to break with Belinsky and his circle not long after his second novella, The Double. So we realize he's quite young now. He's 24 when Poor Folk is published, and it's an immediate success, and he's lionized, and everybody is excited about him. And then at 25, he publishes The Double. And Belinsky tried to be very polite in his review of it and give Dostoevsky good marks, but he was a little bit lukewarm about a good part of it, and for good reason. It doesn't do what Belinsky had expected Dostoevsky to do next. That is, it isn't a piece of political activism. It is in a more Gogolian style, in a sense. It's more fantastic, but it's Dostoevsky's first entry into this intriguing theme of the double, and this will run throughout all his works, all the way up through The Brothers Karamazov. So The Double, his first attempt at this, despite the fact that it draws on Gogol and his Diary of a Madman, does something very un-Gogolian. So Mr. Galyadkin, who is another somewhat Gogol-like, actually he's a copyist in an office. He lives a life that is so completely mechanical that when his double appears, and his double is just like him. His double, in fact, knows everything he knows, apparently, and even causes problems for him by snitching on him. Now, obviously, the motivation here, this is not like the nose, say, because actually, Galyadkin is mad. He's been driven mad by unrequited love on the one hand, and on the other, by this totally deadening, meaningless life that he lives as a very, very minor bureaucrat on the next to the last rung. The stranger appeared from, this is, he sees this man, but he sort of appears and then disappears. And he discovers now that the same man he had glimpsed elsewhere in the street is at the entrance to his apartment. The stranger appeared for a moment at the entrance to the staircase which led to Mr. Galyatkin's flat. Mr. Galyatkin rushed after him. The stairs were dark, damp, and dirty. At every turning, there were heaps of all kinds of trash from the flats. So an unaccustomed stranger who found himself on the stairs in the dark was forced to climb them for a half an hour in danger of breaking his legs, cursing the stairs as well as the friends who lived in such an inconvenient place. But Mr. Galyatkin's companion seemed to be familiar with it, as though he were at home. He ran up lightly, without difficulty, showing a perfect knowledge of the locale. Mr. Galyatkin had almost overtaken him. In fact, once or twice, the skirt of the stranger's coat flicked him on the nose. His heart stood still. The stranger stopped before the door of Mr. Galyatkin's flat, knocked on it, and, which would have surprised Mr. Galyatkin at any other time, Petrushka, his servant, like the one in Gogol, as though he had been waiting up, opened the door at once, and with a candle in his hand, followed the stranger as the latter went in. Beside himself, the hero of our story dashed into his lodging. Without taking off his hat or coat, he walked the length of the little passage and stood still in the doorway of his room as though thunderstruck. All his presentiments had come true. All that he had dreaded and surmised had come to pass in reality. His breath failed him. His head was in a whirl. The stranger, also in his coat and hat, was sitting before him on his bed and with a faint smile and screwed up eyes, nodded to him in a friendly way. Mr. Galyatkin wanted to scream, but could not, to protest in some way, but his strength failed him. His hair stood on end, and he almost fell down with horror. And indeed, there was good reason. He recognized his nocturnal friend. The nocturnal friend was none other than himself. Mr. Galyatkin himself. Another Mr. Galyatkin. But absolutely the same as he himself. In short, what is called his double in every respect. And so what Dostoevsky does with this double notion, we realize after a while that the man is mad. But what's interesting is that the men in his office don't notice anything. They see both of them, and they don't see a double. They just see one person. Because when you're reduced to a mere function, you are a double. You are both this automaton that goes through the world, an appearance, a function, on the one hand, and somewhere else is your double, which is your inner self. And so here Dostoevsky, for the first time in Russian literature, and perhaps even in European literature generally, realizes that there is this cleft, this split between the two aspects of a person. Not, it's a split personality. And this will go on to become, of course, an important motif in his later fiction, but also in not only European literature, but in late 19th century psychology. So we can see a kind of precursor in the nose, where the nose is a kind of split personality. But here Dostoevsky does something with it that's not fantastic, but that probes into the very horrors of the disturbed psyche. And this will go on now for quite a while. So the double was the beginning of a slide in Dostoevsky's reputation. The literati did not like it. They wanted something more like Poor People. He went on to write a number of short stories, of which there's White Nights. This is in 1848. And this is the first of his really interesting female figures. In the earlier stories and short novels, the female figures are either weak or tainted in some fashion, but this is the first of his stories in which he has a positive female figure. And a story called A Weak Heart, which introduces another typical Dostoevskian theme, that of the faint heart. the person who is enfeebled by too much solitude, too much dreaming, too much of a romantic set of aspirations, but who, through erotic disappointment perhaps, and just a dull, dreadful life, then turns to a kind of paralytic mentally, and might even say also affectively. So a destructive force, then any kind of passion, anything that comes into this life, then does this person in. So this is what Dostoevsky means by his title, A Weak Heart. And then finally, in 1849, Dostoevsky was arrested, imprisoned, taken before a firing squad, cruelly, at the last minute, the Tsar announces that they're pardoned, and of course this had all been staged, very obviously. This is under Nicholas I. He is sent to prison, to Siberia, and under very, very flimsy evidence, I might add. And there he spends 4 years, followed by 5 years of military service. So you can imagine what this would mean to a writer who was on the brink, who knew already, Dostoevsky was aware that he had a talent and that he had a great talent. And he was perhaps a little too self-congratulatory about it, but he was in his 20s, his early 20s, as a matter of fact. But he was himself a man who had had epileptic fits, was described by contemporaries who met him as having a pale, sickly complexion. He was a man who had known, on the one hand, a kind of, you might say, split personality of his own, extreme exaltation and excitement on the one hand, and bouts of depression. So he was probably what we'd now call a manic depressive. So when he wrote of psychological themes, he wrote from his own understanding of these things, and not from mere realistic observation. And this gets us to this peculiar aspect of Dostoevsky, which is that his novels both seem to show us the outside and the inside simultaneously. And we really hadn't had anything like this in European fiction before. And this will build, then, in his subsequent work. And so two final works that I just want to draw your attention to, The Insulted and the Injured, which was a great success. It was written after he came out of exile. After 10 years, he returned to St. Petersburg in 1861, published this. By the way, it's the year of Fathers and Sons. And even though he and Turgenev, he disliked Turgenev a great deal when he returned in 1861, he read the manuscript and liked it very much, and Turgenev was very pleased. That didn't last very long, but that's another story. I don't want to get into that. The Insulted and the Injured is very interesting from a technical point of view. It has two parallel plots that are united by a narrator. And this is the beginning of the Dostoevsky narrator. So I didn't mention this, but Poor Folk is an epistolary novel. It's a novel written in letters. The Double has a narrator, an omniscient narrator, but The Insulted and the Injured has a narrator who brings together two parallel but unconnected stories. And he's the first of the Dostoevskian narrators who is a witness and perhaps even a minor participant in the scene, but who isn't omniscient at all. In fact, he's more, shall we say, driven by the characters than a driver of the characters, this narrator. So this, too, is very peculiar, and it's an interesting technical switch that Dostoevsky manages. And finally, The House of the Dead, which Leo Tolstoy considered Dostoevsky's best work, even after The Brothers Karamazov, but that's Tolstoy. Tolstoy, I think, saw in it, though, this dimension of good and evil and suffering that came straight out of Dostoevsky's experience, and he was lucky in this novel, which comes before Notes from the Underground, but like so many of these other works, prefigures this strange, unprecedented figure who is a kind of Nietzsche before Nietzsche. Now, Nietzsche knew Dostoevsky. That is, he had read Dostoevsky. So in some ways, you could say that Dostoevsky anticipated not only the person Nietzsche, but a great deal of his thought in his fictional characters without himself being a Nietzschean. And of course, Raskolnikov is himself a kind of Nietzschean Superman in his own mind. Okay, so I'm going to stop there and turn things over to Dr. Kahn.
So we have put on the table an admirable number of facts on Dostoevsky's background and his early writings, how he connects to the Russian literary scene and how he has relates to the and even to the world of thought around him. We need to ready you for this siege of novels you'll be reading by reminding you of what a genius Dostoevsky is, a genius of modernity, in the way that Dante and Shakespeare were geniuses of the Christian world and the Christian universe. But Dostoevsky is a writer who perceives the world that we still share with him to an extraordinary depth. His writings are prophetic. He diagnoses the conditions of modernity and shows us the dangers. And through him, we understand the roots, for instance, of terrorism, especially in the second and third of his novels that we'll be reading, The Devils and the Brothers Karamazov. André Glucksmann, a French philosopher, neo-philosopher, wrote a book recently called Dostoevsky in Manhattan. In response to the 9/11 event. And he makes this affirmation that Dostoevsky is a key to understanding our time because he claims behind everything motivating terrorism is not religion nor any specific ideology, but simply nihilism, the way that Dostoevsky understands it. Nihilism, a belief in nothing, a will to tear everything down. You will see a markedly more negative a representation of nihilism in The Idiot already, and certainly then in the novels that follow, than you saw in Fathers and Sons, in comparison to which Bazarov in Fathers and Sons is a romantic sweetheart, isn't he? Dostoevsky helps us to understand the catastrophic changes, not only those that took place in the 20th century, but those that are taking place now. And that, I think, is why we turn back to him, the enormous cauldrons of insight that his novels bid for us, the challenge to read them is one that, once we're into the tractor pull,
tractor beam.
The tractor beam, there you go. I've been in Louisiana too long. once you're in the tractor beam of the novel, right, you are a captive, I think, forever. Now, nonetheless, for all this, It's a fact that Dostoevsky has been not approved of by many leaders in high culture and humanities and literature. And the reason, I think, is clear enough that he writes novels that are not the well-made novel. We just read a novel that I've called the perfect novel, The Fathers and Sons. You know, it has a beautiful arc. Everything seems to take place with a kind of serenity, even the terribly moving moments, right? Dostoevsky's novels happen with pell-mell action. They are grotesque, and they're ironic, and they're polyphonic, as Bakhtin first called them. Many different voices, many different tones speak out throughout these novels. It's hard to step back like the viewer of the painter and viewer of the painting and get the right perspective on it all. It comes at you. Moreover, these novels are deeply ambivalent. Long and deeply convincing speeches are given to people with quite different views from Dostoevsky, not even to say that Dostoevsky is saying, now this person is wrong, right? But that he's working something out, you know, that is not at all what Dostoevsky himself believes, but is something that has to be considered. And so what position do we take on this? Right? He's deeply ambivalent and he's erratic. And again, the pressure of producing a novel in installments for the journals as he was turning them out was one thing that influenced him to always end on the most tense note, on a cliffhanger, you know, what Hollywood would come to call the cliffhanger. A typical scene has two people or two groups of people get into a discussion about a third person who is a very controversial person, and one side loves him and the other side hates him, and they get into an enormous verbal battle about him. And then there's a knock at the door, and it's that person, and that ends the chapter. Right? So, boom, it's always, you know, the tension always has to be knocked up a notch. There's nothing continuous in Dostoevsky's art. So for these reasons, he's been said by many critics who are set in their ways, right, for that he is not in control of his material. Jacques Barzin, I'm told by Louise Cowan, said personally to her, why do you teach that bad man? So another possibility is that we simply read his characters as representing him. And boy, his characters do many, many bad things. none of this could be farther from the truth. Dostoevsky was, of course, deeply and openly religious. At the same time, he was really a concerned artist. He was not writing religious works, but writing a work of art. The great works of art have always had a metaphysical dimension. Right? The gods don't have to appear. Think of Sophocles and the stage there, which, you know, even in ancient Greece, where you could have gods on the stage, his stage is disconcertingly bare. Hero has to face as alone with his fate, as it were. And even in Dante, we never see God, right? We see the celestial angels.
You just see God, sort of.
If you squint.
I saw the sun and other stars.
No, he did, but we don't.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Good save, thank you. Poetry just doesn't take us that far. It's not meant for the vision of God or the vision of the gods, but it can give us a sense of reality. And this is the point, incidentally, that Caroline Gordon made in defending her view of what makes great fiction. Incidentally, Caroline Gordon despised Dostoevsky until I think she ended up being an admirer of Dostoevsky after hanging around the University of Dallas for long enough. But her view, and I think this is the correct view, is how do you write good Catholic fiction? How do you write good religious fiction? And she said, write good fiction. Right? Write fiction that doesn't teach a moral, and doesn't show the moral life, doesn't show the solution for how to end culture's problems, how to resolve culture's problems. Write something that shows us our life. Right? Write reality. And this was Dostoevsky's great goal. This is why Dostoevsky, and truly any important novelist, is a novelist. Reality is what we miss if we simply, blindly and unthinkingly follow, as we have to from time to time, the dominant scientism of our own day, in which we simply cordon off judgment on so many things and leave them to the experts who are constantly at our ear. Great writers have always made us aware that reality doesn't have just these limited dimensions, that our publicity world and our world of science and world of authority emphasizes to us. Now, if the novel, here's just thinking about novels in general, if the novel offers a particular opportunity for someone who says we must, you know, must reveal reality, right? The medium is going to be the novel here. But the novel then also is a particular problem, because once you start to portray everyday reality, you're facing the same problems as you are as an ordinary citizen, right? You are living that same world. Your characters are plunged in that same world. And you are then left with the problem of how to deal with the official view of the world. Dostoevsky came into this role gradually, and by the time that of the works that Dr. Dupree has been telling you about, he had not yet really arrived at that moment. But as Dr. Dupree also was making you aware, some big and catastrophic changes happened in his life. And it's after those times that the great works of his began to come out. So he was sentenced to hard labor in Siberia. And one point about that is that you had to walk there. Okay, I think I might have to, you know, impress that point on you, because that just, it doesn't sound credible at all. But you'd have to walk there. And have you seen Russia on the map? And one thing that he encountered in going through little peasant villages and so forth, people, you know, again, and everyone was out of touch with everyone, obviously. people from the village would come out because they'd see this troop of prisoners walking their way to Siberia, and they'd come out from the towns and watch them. And their idea was, well, we're all sinners, right? These poor people have to suffer to the utmost for all of us. So compare that, perhaps, to our society's regular treatment of somebody who has gotten caught lately. I don't want to mention any names. Why mention names? There's always somebody, right? Yeah. Enough editorializing. Yes, huh?
What was the point of walking? Wasn't the Trans-Siberian Railroad built by then?
Yeah, for paying customers. But the you know, again, when Peter the Great commissioned his city to be built out of nothing, he conscripted serfs to come from everywhere to walk there. And remember, without tools, and build the city.
Does it seem very economical to take several years just to get there?
Yeah, well, that's how the human race has existed all this time. See, I mean, that's what we're up against here. We're not even aware of some of these basic facts about our species' existence. It's a little weird, but there it is. I'm not to single you out, but I'm just saying I think that's very typical of how we think as moderns. So one woman brought him a New Testament, and that, he said, was of considerable significance to him. It remained with him the entire time. But when you read his Diary of a Writer, the column that he wrote as a literary man for the journals in the last part of his life, you read a very urbane, sophisticated, aware writer who has a very balanced judgment on cultural events and political events and so forth. He's not someone who is himself wild or imbalanced. Not himself a propagandist. He's concerned for what's the, you know, the soberest and most reasonable response to things. So it's something, I think it's an interesting experience just to read a little bit in those essays in the Diary of a Writer, because we need to banish from our mind. On the one hand, it's as Dr. Dupree said, he had some intense experiences in his life, and it allowed him to get inside the world that he was to portray. On the other hand, you know, we must try, we must succeed in banishing from our minds the idea that here is some wild-eyed rider. The same, well, same mistake often that people make about riders across the board. Right. You have to think of him as a sane and very literary man. On the third hand, he was for sounding so urbane. He was always desperately poor. Right. He had a debilitating addiction to gambling until late in his life, and all these things made him desperate for some way, and they also kept him writing. Right. So we have the whole story of how he wrote *Crime and Punishment*. Have we already told that one? Oh, okay. I'm gonna get lost. But he was he'd been working on *The Gambler*. Again, drawn on his own life, and he'd promised his publisher, in a wager, as it were, all of the rights to his own writing if he didn't get the novel finished by a certain time, November of 1864, I believe it was. And he was blocked. He couldn't write anything. At the last minute, he sent to a stenographic agency, and they sent a young girl, an 18-year-old young woman named Anna Smitkina, who agreed to just take my dictation, whatever he would say. And this broke the floodgates. He finished *The Gambler* in a jiffy, and began working right away on *Crime and Punishment*. And *Crime and Punishment* was finished in 1866, and he and Anna Smitkina were married 6 months later. And their marriage is one of the happiest in all the annals of of literary people. Now, okay, so 1864, and Dr. Dupree has given us the start on these dates. Notes from Underground. 1866, *Crime and Punishment*. *1869, *The Idiot*. 1872, *The Devils* or *The Possessed*, and then 1881, *The Brothers Karamazov*. The last year of his life. Double checking the dates on this, and he died a celebrity. Largely because of the speech that he gave at the unveiling of the Pushkin Monument, which was a magnificent speech. You must read it sometime. It's about the spirit of and future of Russia.
I'll put it on Blackboard.
Yeah, it's a good one. So Dostoevsky, we have to say, was then not against reason, right? But he was against rationalism. Rationalism wants to exclude the form of things, and Dostoevsky saw too deeply into the form of things for that. He was aware that the logical faculty, the lower reason, was becoming the dominant thing that society was turning to. And this is what C.S. Lewis called men without chests, right? Men who think with the top of their heads, not with their whole being. And it was this, above all, over and over, that he excoriated. Notes from Underground was written really about this as a protest to this. So Notes from Underground is really his first great work. Now, Scott, I see that you do have a copy of the text, and I'm hoping to read the first paragraph at some point. So,
there we are.
Okay, thanks. I forgot to bring it with me.
Oh, here's another one, too.
Good. Okay.
They're probably both Constance Garnett. I didn't check.
I bet they are. What would we do without her? Actually, Notes from Underground was planned as a journalistic attack on that novel that you have already heard about, What is to be Done, right? Что делать, by Chernyshevsky, which was written in prison by him and was written to be the solution to that critical problem of why don't we have a positive hero? And our positive hero, of course, must be a utilitarian, a leftist utilitarian, and a disciplined hero, therefore, and so forth and so on. Dostoevsky conceived a work of fiction that would just simply blow that to smithereens. And so he creates the most ironic first-person narrator that, had ever been known up to that point. Gradually, his story began to assume greater dimensions in his mind, and he wrote that somehow the idea becomes too strange and the poetry will have to soften it and carry it off. But as he went on, it became more intense, and at the center of the maelstrom is a small voice, an underground mouse, a little mouse of a man who saw through the boastful claims of modern society and claims in response that they're going to make us all India rubber men. His protest was against the tyranny of facts. It is a classic of existentialism and was celebrated as such in the 20th century. Notes from Underground as the first to probe the tormentedness of modernity. Often Dostoevsky was linked then with Nietzsche, with Kierkegaard, and with Kafka as being those great writers who saw into the chaos of the abyss at the heart of modernity and the existential crisis that this was to provoke. Now, our narrator in Notes from Underground is again someone who looks on society from the outside as an observer, as in other words, as a nobody, right, looking on society. A Prufrock, if you will, an étranger, as Camus' étranger. He is empowered by himself to diagnose all the ills of the age, right? And so let me read the beginning of it. First words, I am a sick man. I am a spiteful man. I am an unattractive man. I believe my liver is diseased. It's wonderful stuff, isn't it? However, I know nothing at all about my disease and do not know for certain what ails me. I don't consult a doctor for it and never have, though I have a respect for medicine and doctors. Besides, I am extremely superstitious, sufficiently so to respect medicine anyway. No, I refuse to consult a doctor from spite. That you probably will not understand. Well, I understand it, though. Of course, I can't explain who it is precisely that I am mortifying, in this case, by my spite. I am perfectly well aware that I cannot pay out the doctors by not consulting them. I know better than anyone that by all this I'm only injuring myself and no one else. But still, if I don't consult a doctor, it is from spite. My liver is bad. Well, let it get worse. That'll show whoever, right? So an attack certainly from the existential point of view, from one's own experience, from the experiential point of view, on making sense, on the utilitarian view of life. If it has to begin in my liver, then let it begin there. Right? He believed that he was attacking the socialists who believed that reason alone
could perfect the world, the people who believe that if you would just see the reasonable and rational thing to do, utopia itself would be created. Now, the underground man bitterly resents this view, and it leads him to various poses of absurdity, as we've just seen demonstrated. And he says, if the only way that I can derail this idea is by claiming 2 + 2 = 5, I will say 2 + 2 = 5. So perversity is what the underground man gives into in the name of freedom. So we have the notion really that the cards are put on the table for all of what existentialism has to say in the 20th century. Yes?
He sounds like, I don't know, is he supposed to be the same kind of person as like Evgeny Bazarov? Because he sounds very much like, I'm just going to throw everything out the window.
No, I mean, in some ways he's the exact opposite. And the exact opposite in the sense that Bazarov believes that there's a sensible way to do things, and we have to disregard what's been done in order to see that sensible way.
Okay.
So in fact, Bazarov is just a very, very well put version of what the underground man is attacking.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Just to clarify, you said he was advocating for existentialism, or he was attacking it?
Oh no, existentialism comes after Dostoevsky and considers Dostoevsky a kind of pillar, an early insight into the crisis that they wrote. So utilitarianism is what he's attacking. And his term for this palace of belief in that rational future that we can all walk into if we'll just start seeing things the rational way was the Crystal Palace. Now, the Crystal Palace was built in London in 1851 for an exhibition there. And we have a copy of it so happens, in the Information Mart downtown in Dallas. so you can see exactly what it looks like. It was an enormous thing in London, and actually had almost whole ecosystems inside it. Right, it had a tree, had trees there, and the tree actually started presenting problems because birds nested in it and got everybody dirty. And the Queen said, at one time, I forget who she asked this of, but how can we do anything about this? He said, "I'll bring my falcon, ma'am." And so we had a falcon inside the Crystal Palace. That was the real Crystal Palace. For Dostoevsky, it's an ideational structure. It's just simply an image of the structure of the house that utilitarianism wanted to build. And for him especially, it meant that endeavor to turn all the energies of a society to profit, right? The English way, which for a Russian is a horror, right? English and certainly the American. And another term he had for the utopian dream was the Golden Age. Right? And the Golden Age was a dangerous myth, according to Dostoevsky. It's one of the most dangerous ideas ever wreaked on the human race because of its supposition that there was a time in which everything was in wonderful balance. If only we could just get natural and go back to it. Right. There are ways of not accepting our humanity. It's ways of not accepting our reality. So, our speaker here in Notes from Underground had been a worker in the government for 20 years. He was a civil servant in a low office. He was a bad civil servant by his own account, and couldn't go on, and decided at the same time that to go on living after 40 is unseemly and immoral. But a relative had left him some money, so he is able to go on and live in this little flat underground, literally. In his speaking, he assumes an audience of informed people. He assumes they will ridicule him. So at times it seems like he's almost picking a fight with his reader, and at times he just lets that go. But in there, he triumphs over his opponents in their rigidity. Since he has a nonstop monologue, we do get an undertone of sense that his battles are in fact too easily won. You know, he's not telling the whole story himself. But he does say, I swear to you, that to think too much is positively a disease, especially in Petersburg, the most abstract and premeditated city in the whole world. And he goes on taking pot shots at progress and everything. Everyone thinks it's good, right? This little mouse is perverse. By the end of the first part, you realize that he has been wounded and he's hiding it deeply, that he has no place to go, that he's filled with resentment and utterly alone. What he has masked throughout the first part is his own emotional reality, his own experience, his life. So there's a part one and a part two. And then the second part, this all comes in, comes to light. So the second part tells us about a memory 20 years ago that he has. Long ago, and says as he grew up, he was always made fun of by classmates, but remembers a party that he went to as a young man, and one in which he was ill-received, and nobody laughed at his jokes. And afterwards, at some point, he would scorn them, at other points, he'd want to fit in. All the stuff of 21st century movies and stories and so forth. Afterwards, all the young men went out to a whorehouse, so he went along. And there he encountered a young prostitute. And just out of sheer perversity, he decided to make friends with her and sympathize with her and listen to her. And she opens her heart to him. So he leaves feeling he has conquered something. Now then later, in about a week, he recalls, all this happened long ago, she comes to visit him at his little mouse hole. And he is ashamed of his place, and because he's ashamed, right, he turns perverse. Something perverse takes hold of him, whereas before he had been encouraging her to get out of this line of work and to do something with herself and so forth, to think something of herself, make something of herself. He decides now to torture her. And so he takes her by force and then tells her the story of his life, lets himself go enough that he realizes that he's sounding pitiful. And again, perversity arises. He sees on her face a look of sympathy, and that drives him mad. And he tries to hurt her, not physically, but to be very cruel to her, mentally. As she leaves, he presses into her hand a 5-ruble note. She had come to him not as a paid prostitute, but as a friend. So this is a terrible insult to her. It wounds her very deeply, and he's aware. It's a vicious, dreadful act. And we can tell that he feels bad about it. But he tells himself that this is life. Perhaps it will be good for her to have been treated this way because she knows more about life now than she did. One does hear these things. Self-justification. Excuse me. So Dostoevsky can, you see what he does. He can tell us a wonderful critique. And then it doesn't exactly pull the carpet out from it in terms of ideas, but shows us the experiential base on which our lives rest. Tells us so much more about what makes the human heart tick, that insatiable desire for dignity and superiority that seems to exist in all of us, and that comes out with a special hunger in a character like the man from Underground. So, but at the same time, you know, again, with another turn of the wheel, he's been telling us all this, rather than being somebody who hides it and lies about it. So, we realize that this is the wound that he's carried with him all this time, and it has given him a sense of resentment and alienation from the world. And there's a hint at the end of the work when he talks about the real Crystal Palace. that could come about when people care about each other, and we're aware that he longs for belief, he longs for the good, but he is caught nonetheless in this ressentiment, in this character that cannot get outside his own bitterness. Okay. Ressentiment is Nietzsche's word, so it, again, something perhaps showing the kinship of Nietzsche later, but it means literally to ressentir. Sentir is to feel, and ressentir is to feel again, right? And so it is to go back over some slight, some injury that has been done to you until it becomes something that you become deeply, deeply bitter about, to hold on to it and treasure this negativity that you have been dealt. This is a notion of resentment. I think the way that it works in Dostoevsky. Now, The Underground Man was a big sensation and it struck all of the writers in Europe. It made them aware of what was going on in Russia in his time. We could say it was really, in some sense, famous to this day. It is, in a sense, the beginning of postmodernity, because it is the first extended criticism of the ambitions of the utilitarian modern world that has been in charge for a long time. So this character who is withdrawn from society thinks that he is brighter than anyone in society, yet he feels inferior and resents everyone else, thinks he's been mistreated, imagines mistreatments he might have gotten, and is angry about them, right? So there's no limit once you get started down that road. But this is somewhat in all of us. Some of this is indeed in all of us. It's in our times. The writers like Nietzsche and Dostoevsky and Kierkegaard saw that when man is cut off from his connections, he is bitter and full of resentment. But what we see, especially in Dostoevsky, is it has a special art at showing an isolated man who has done what he can to sever those last ties that connect him to the human community. Now, one of the things that he said he rediscovered in prison and on that path to prison was the Russian sense of community, a notion of sobornost that we've mentioned before, which is a deep Russian belief. And which literally would mean togetherness, but that has a rather simple, limp sound in English. So we'll just call it sobornost. The Russian thought of himself as part of an organic whole. Petersburg was conceived in opposition to this idea as a modern city that would house individuals. And convert everyone there into individuals. So this leads up then to Crime and Punishment, and Raskolnikov, perhaps the if anything, the most powerful portrait of the isolated individual that Dostoevsky gives us. There's always a connection between Notes from Underground and Crime and Punishment. And I know some of you in this class will have read Crime and Punishment. It's in the core curriculum here. Some of you may have not. So that gives me a little time to go over it a little bit quickly, because it is truly a great novel. And we have to say that these four, Notes from Underground is more a novella. It's short, and it's a monologue. So, in some senses, it is not a novel, although it is a work, certainly. But Crime and Punishment and the three great novels that follow that we're reading make an incredible canon of masterpieces. And Crime and Punishment is included in the core here because it is such a complete novel that shows really all the vision, the height and the depth of Dostoevsky's vision. So with him, our individual hero is the young Raskolnikov, who lives not underground, but up in a garret, right, and has cut himself off again in the same way. He is a college student at the university in Petersburg, has cut himself off, no longer going to classes, no longer taking work, and thinking, as he says. Right? And as he thinks, he becomes increasingly bitter. Now, the word Raskol means schism. So, am I right? Is it? The word that is the word for the great schism between the Eastern and Western Church, but it can also mean it in a more general sense. And so, one who has broken off, right, is our Raskolnik. Right, he's the son of Raskolnik, but he's obviously what Dostoevsky means is to give us a character who whose name tells us something about him. So he is someone who wants nothing to do with the world around him. He also is cooking a plan out of this bitterness and resentment that drives him in his life. And we see some of the reasons for that is that his mother is paupering herself by sending him to college and sending him money for college. So it's kindness that can be the most, the thing that causes you the most bitterness, right? In that you are... You have a complicated relation to your mother, and so you are both, you see what she's doing, that she's in fact impoverishing herself by letting you live your life, so you feel very bad about that. And as Raskolnikov has turned away from everyone, this becomes simply something that he pushes down and uses to fuel his general resentment. And he comes up with a scheme, incidentally, and he's always thinking about Napoleon. Now, there have been other novelistic heroes before him who are always modeling themselves on Napoleon. It's not so much that it would be a convention, but it is something that we know about from Stendhal's The Red and the Black. He comes up with a crazy scheme, and that is to kill an insignificant louse of a woman, a pawnbroker woman in Petersburg, who has been a very minor oppressor of students. In other words, they'll take her stuff, and she will give them a terribly low price for them, and so forth. But to kill her, to show, really ostensibly, as a gesture of social justice, right? But actually, to show something to himself, to prove something to himself that he is a Napoleon, that he is. Again, it seems hard to deny that this is Nietzsche's, one version of Nietzsche's idea, the Superman, that he is the Übermensch. Right? Although it is a version of the Übermensch that Nietzsche would deny. But only because he'd read Dostoevsky. It's complicated, the question of the relation between Dostoevsky and Nietzsche. But Dostoevsky, really, with this character, Raskolnikov, he creates a literary experiment that is like an experiment in life itself because he lives this character out so thoroughly. So he goes on with the murder as he's planned it. He finds that there's one big thing that he had not counted on, and that is that as he kills the old pawnbroker woman with an axe, this half-sister of the pawnbroker woman walks in at that time and sees the murder. And this is Lizaveta, who has been introduced to us already in the novel. She's a kind woman. She's mentally challenged. She's everybody loves her, so this is a terrible thing. He sees that she's seen him, and so he has to kill her. So he kills her. So right with this iconic moment, he realized we have presented the consequence, right? The unexpected consequence of your deeds, right? That if one chooses to kill the bad, the good is there to be killed along with it. has to be killed along with it. So Dostoevsky portrays this with incredible power. And that's just the beginning, right? That's just the beginning. The question, though, is what has he done by this murder, this horrible act that certainly dramatizes and certainly finalizes his break from the human community? And it's quite easy to see in the novel in religious terms as well as in legal terms. Constantly, the whole novel, things are being talked about in legal terms and in religious terms. So they're not in opposition to each other, but on two different levels. So Raskolnikov has cut himself off, certainly as well from the world of grace. But it's also true that he's taken a definitive step, the first step away from the lostness that he has been in by committing this terrible crime. Not if we follow his own trajectory, not if left to himself, but it's through his life after this that he finds the Marmeladov family. Again, another name that in a somewhat more comical way tells itself, right? This is a family of bittersweet people, right? So Marmeladov, he gets first to know the father, who is a hopeless drunk, and who, as he tells in a long monologue, loves suffering, loves to degrade himself so that he may be abused by his wife. Because why? Because he deserves it. So it's perversity in the opposite direction, if you will, from our underground man. And, you know, Dostoevsky also has a wonderful way of embodying his what he thinks any negative reading will be. So while he's telling Raskolnikov this story, all around him are these pubgoers that are, pretty much in their cups, too, and are jeering at him and saying, oh, there he goes again. You know, what a masochist, and oh, this is rare, and so forth. You know, so the reader, a negative reader of this scene is already parodied by Dostoevsky. But his family, then, is in terrible poverty, and Dostoevsky gets to know them. And the daughter there is Sonya, who has been sent off into prostitution in order to keep the family alive. And this is Sonya, which is her diminutive name. Her name is based on Sophia, holy wisdom. Right, and so we have in Sonya a character who is in fact the redemptive force in the book. And as he gets to know her, he wants first of all to take that superior attitude that the underground man had as a kindly, in his kindly phase toward the prostitute whom he got to know, to tell her, you need to make something of yourself. Think of a good life that you could live, and so forth, trying to give her good practical advice. But as he goes on, he becomes more and more frustrated by her reliance on religion. I trust in God. He wants, first of all, to shake that up. How can you believe in a God who has caused this? What has God done for you? He says. And she has been meek, again, really like a mouse, says, be silent. She says, you don't understand, she said. He does everything for me. And at one point, and she brings the Bible with her in another meeting that they have, and they read together the resurrection of Lazarus from the Bible. All this leads gradually through many, many protests and many superior feelings and ironic comments by Raskolnikov to a moment in which he does actually confess his murder to her, the first person whom he has let know that this has happened. Although there is also a detective in the novel who's been on his heels and who we think by this time probably has figured out that Raskolnikov is the murderer. So he confesses to Sonya, and Sonya, of course, is devastated, but not in a way that he might expect, not in a way that readers might expect, because Lizaveta was a personal friend of hers. And she might very well have been horrified for Lizaveta's sake, or that the law has been broken and it's such a terrible crime. But what she says to him is, what have you done to yourself? Again, Raskolnikov does all he can to ironize and to throw cold water, to distance himself from what she's telling him. But again, and without going through the plot of the whole novel, well, she is effective, eventually. but not in a way that we would perhaps even like if we wanted this to be a nice moral tale. So it's a marvelous, wonderful, wonderful novel. You must read it if you haven't read it. I have to mention another extremely important character, and that is Svidrigaïlov. Really original character. Well, there have been master criminals portrayed before in French fiction and so forth, but somebody that's not what Svidrigaïlov is. He's not a dedicated criminal. He's somebody, it's just fascinating to read about him because to get to know him in Crime and Punishment, as he is sophisticated, I want to say devil may care. that really describes him in a very good way. Somebody who is indeed cut off from his world, but has a reputation of having ruined young women, and takes an interest in Raskolnikov. And strangely, at that scene in which Raskolnikov confesses his murder to Sonya, he has rented a room next to their room because they've been to this room before to talk. And he's done it so that he could overhear them because he takes pleasure in hearing their conversation. So at the same time that he's confessing to Sonya, he's confessing to Svidrigaïlov. Svidrigaïlov is an interesting character because he's not a rubber-stamped villain. You know, he is shown to be a complicated man, one who has simply given up on the good. There are times in which he has motivations for the good, but he eventually is more or less sure that he's not going to be capable of it, that anything that he tries to undertake for good is going to be corrupted by him. And this is something, again, he is unable to be deeply troubled by these things, and so he wants to get Raskolnikov to be the same way. Misery loves company, and then we can go on saying that our life is a good life. He is finally interested in Raskolnikov's sister, and Raskolnikov has to resist him. But it's really his sister, it's really Dunya, who resists him most effectively. And at the end, near the end of the story, Svidrigaïlov goes off, actually leaves money to the Raskolnikov family, to Dunya and her family, and goes off and rents a hotel room and, gosh, now I've forgotten what part of this is dream and what part is reality. Does he actually see a little girl that's in distress, or is he just...
No, I think that's the dream.
Okay, so he has a dream that night in which he sees a little girl in distress. I'll take coaching from any of you that have read the novel, too. And he wraps her up and takes her, to a warm room and so forth and leaves her there. And then in his dream, he wakes up, and she is metamorphosed into a harlot with an allure, with painted and with alluring looks and so forth. And he realizes, my God, I've corrupted her, even her, And it's after that that Dostoevsky doesn't tell us, but he shows us that he decides that there's no way out for him. He's going to kill himself. And the last thing he says is that he's going to America before he pulls the trigger. So we have with Raskolnikov and Svidrigaïlov two very different versions, two very different visions of evil. Two phases. And they might be put in a more traditional way that we're well familiar with. Raskolnikov, the rebel, the one who says, I will not serve, who turns away from the powers that be to assert himself, to go after what he thinks is the good, even though it must trample on people. So there is, in other words, a Luciferian notion of evil as it's manifested in Raskolnikov, who he is and what he does. And it's a belief still that what he's doing is good, right? Can be justified as good. There is a way that Raskolnikov can be brought back through this. And it's Sonya's particular suffering to try to do this for him. In fact, it's also the detective, because the detective is not just an ordinary detective, but it also seems to be one who is more interested in saving Raskolnikov's soul than in making a collar. At the end of the novel, last words of the novel are Raskolnikov's public confession. But then, not public, I'm sorry, in the police department. And then after that comes an epilogue. And the epilogue is all important.
Because it's
all important. Some editions early on left them out. But in the epilogue, our Raskolnikov is in Siberia. And he's been there a long time, and the prisoners have come to hate him and almost to kill him. But Sonya comes and is there. And then she's sick and doesn't visit him for a while, and he begins to miss her terribly, and he realizes for the first time how much he loves her and needs her. And then she comes back, and there's this final great iconic scene. Well, you got to read it yourself. It's just terrific. Life begins anew for Raskolnikov after this scene. All of that because of Sonya. And it's at that point that you're able to say that the whole trajectory of Raskolnikov's life couldn't have begun without the crime. Right? So the felix culpa, the happy fault, is affirmed in that plot. The other vision of evil is more of Satan. And that transformation is one you're familiar with in Paradise Lost, as in the early innings, Satan is a noble hero, has certain overtones of admirable nature, and seems like a proud but almost justified rebel. But at that moment, he turns and says, "Evil, be thou my good." That's an existential choice. And this is, we see Svidrigailov as one who has already long made that choice. Cannot believe in the good anymore. He's lost within his own universe. And at a moment in which he sees that the good is something that he would not only not be able to attain, but would corrupt, then that despair actually is too much for him at that point. So, I mean, it's a magnificent, profound work. And we're not going to read it. It's a tight, tight plot. One of the reasons why it's so good to teach to sophomores. A long novel, but not as long as the ones we have. Tighter than The Idiot. More easy to follow than The Possessed, and so forth. In it, really, the whole universe is in some way described. The heights of Sonya, because she really, her prostitution means that she doesn't represent the holy in any low way, right? That's all off the board. She is the representation of holy wisdom. The depths of the evil that Svidrigailov and Raskolnikov fall into. So, and then the whole world in between. This is all set in Petersburg. It's a wonderful boulevard novel in the sense that he gets all the grime and street noise At one point, he has Raskolnikov go out and stroll in Petersburg, and there's an organ grinder that cranks up, and he says, I just love when there's an off-key organ grinder playing, and it's a miserable night, and everything is foul. He says, I get such a wonderful feeling. I'm exaggerating. He doesn't quite say it that way, but somebody else is listening to him at that point, and he's saying this to her or to him. Another person says, I don't know. Excuse me. You know, little touches like that just make the novel so real. So it's a magnificent thing. So this is our introduction to Dostoevsky. And we're going to set another novel in Petersburg here in The Idiot. And I hope you'll keep some of these characters, these images, these concerns in your minds as you're reading through The Idiot. Now, the first half of it is going to be quizzed next time. So.
Does that mean part one and two?
No, I'm sorry. We're not. I'm always wrong about this. I'm sorry. It's a week from now, isn't it? You've got plenty of time. Just a 600-page novel. You've got plenty of time. We have four parts. Is that right? In The Idiot? So parts one and two. It really does divide fairly evenly.